This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night.
Sugi, AWP comes to my hometown and you just totally blow it off. I don't understand.
I had to go to my hometown.
Okay. But I was... Well, that seems like a good answer.
It was, I think it's a testament to what a good conference AWP is that I was like genuinely like Sri Lanka, AWP, Sri Lanka, AWP. So tell me about the good stuff. What happened?
The big, tremendous gossip of the conference was that they lost the tote bags.
Oh, I heard about this actually. There you go. It actually is the real dish.
And my school was sponsoring, so we'd spent all of this money and were on the tote bag, which we were very excited about, and then...
Oh, no.
Yeah. I've got four, though. I went today, actually, early, and they had like 400 or something, and I got four of those 400. So I have four $2,500 tote bags at my house.
Good times.
But anything it was fun. It was fun to see everyone. The panels were good. I was on a couple that I really enjoyed. And we did one on podcasting. And we did one that you were supposed to be on that you weren't there for. And then I did another one with the writers from Kansas City and Tulsa, which I thought was really great. That was organized by Rila Askew.
That's awesome. I heard that there were some panels about Ukraine.
I'm sure there were. Yes. I mean, you know, I've been following the war. I feel like American interest in the war is down significantly, you know, but it's only 2 years ago that this war started.
Yeah. Do you remember, like, we did that episode with Anton Tarnowski, the Moscow bureau chief of the New York Times, and Marcy Shore, who's a historian from Yale. And it was about, like, if there will be a Russian invasion of Ukraine. We've never had such a prescient episode, and I really wish that had been wrong. Anyway, it seems like forever ago, but it is 2 years, and now Congress is debating an emergency aid bill that includes about $60 billion for Ukraine. I'm always like, when you round and it's in the billions, I'm like, what? Anyway, so we're taping this a Sunday morning, my time, because I'm in Sri Lanka, and Saturday night, WITS time, February 10th, and senators are working on this bill this weekend and trying to come to an agreement about it.
Given this sort of pivotal political moment, we wanted to bring an old friend with some expertise back to the show to discuss what it means and how things stand in Ukraine at this moment. So we're thrilled today to be joined by the novelist Matt Gallagher.
Matt Gallagher is the author of the novels Empire City and Youngblood, a finalist for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize. His work has appeared in Esquire, ESPN, The New York Times, The Paris Review, and Wired, among other places. He's also the author of the Iraq War memoir, Kaboom, and editor of and contributor to the short fiction collection Fire and Forget, Short Stories from the Long War. His new novel, Daybreak, which is out Tuesday, is set in Ukraine. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back with you all.
Thanks for being here. You were like on like our second episode or very early on in the show. So it's a nice callback, and you've been on since.
Yeah, I think the first, we discussed Kaepernick and kneeling with the American flag. So
that's right.
It has been a few years.
You were actually like the original guest.
Was it the first show?
It was like the that's. That's the first episode. It was like Matt and Britt Bennett talking about Colin Kaepernick.
That's
and
right.
like,
yeah,
yeah, and like
still a good episode.
And yeah, we will link to it in our show notes. And Matt, you might actually be holding the record now for return guest.
The Niners would be a hell of a lot better with Kaepernick playing quarterback than Purdy. It's my personal view.
When I
lose to the Chiefs tomorrow.
I am with you 100%. I might be America's foremost Brock Purdy hater, and it's caused great consternation on my chat with my old high school friends who are mostly Niners fans. But
I'm cutting all of this if the Chiefs lose.
Fair enough.
So Matt, as our regular listeners know, you're a veteran of the Iraq War and journalist, in addition to being a novelist. And after Russia invaded Ukraine 2 years ago, you went there to write about it for Esquire. You published a few pieces. You've written essays about it and published those elsewhere as well. And you're in touch with people on the ground there now. So just as kind of a starting point, we want to give our listeners a little bit of a lay of the land. What is the situation for the Ukrainian military and Ukrainian civilians now?
There's a kind of grim resolve, I would say, that has settled in. It's very clear both to the civilian population and certainly the military that there's no white knight that's going to come charging across the border to save them, that 2 years in, any kind of support they're getting both from the states and their European allies is going to be conditional and often in increments, smaller increments than they would prefer and need. And there's a real sense of betrayal, to be frank, the headlines globally 2 years ago, support Ukraine, Ukrainian flags on kind of every Twitter bio, every social media account. Well, what does that really mean? And here we are 2 years in, which is maybe not that long in the grand scheme of things. And they feel largely alone, with perhaps the exception of Poland and the Baltic states, who are not coincidentally border states with Russia, who are still kind of full throttle support as much as they can. That said, so that's the grim part of it. The resolve part of it is, and I do think this is kind of hard for Americans to wrap their heads around, this is not a choice. This is they've seen the cities like Mariupol and in the east be completely razed by Russia. They've seen Ukrainian children taken from families and sent to cultural re-education camps in Russia. This is not like many American wars that we're familiar with. We tend to view this concept through. It's a war for survival, and so they're dug in. They, from Lviv in the west, all the way out to Kharkiv and Kherson in the east, they're in it for the long haul, and they're fighting for their survival. But they're increasingly understanding that this is a battle that they're going to be fighting on their own, and it comes with a lot of ugly thoughts and ugly emotions, particularly after the kind of the start of this war when, they were the world's darling for a few months at least.
I guess when you say ugly emotions, do you mean like if you're an American there in Ukraine now, that's something you personally hear, that people are angry at you or on behalf of the country?
Oh, very much. Even amongst friends, they don't necessarily accuse me or my photographer Benjamin Bush, because we've been there so many times now, we know them, but they'll ask, is America willing to fight Russia till the last dead Ukrainian? And it's a very pointed question. And the first time I heard it, I thought it was ridiculous. And the longer this drags out and the more I see how our government conducts itself, I'm not sure it is so ridiculous. And then you have encounters with people who don't know you, and they're weird, they're strange. And I'm thinking particularly on our last trip, we were eating dinner in Odessa. So we kind of finished our trip to the front. The sense of real palpable danger had for us, at least for my little team of myself, my photographer, and our interpreter, had kind of passed. And Odessa was relatively safe, you know, under threat of cruise missiles and artillery, but life was normal. Street life was active. We went to a restaurant, and of course, the table next to us are soldiers drinking heavily on leave. They hear us speaking American English, and in their minds, we are CIA. We are envoys of the Biden administration. We are Navy SEALs. All these things at once. We can't just be simple journalists, right? They need us to be something more. And you know, to be frank, it's a very difficult thing to look at somebody in the eye begging you for modern equipment, a modern rifle, a modern helmet. And you know, I'm looking there. These are young men in their 20s and 30s. The one in particular that I'm remembering was a car mechanic before the war broke out. And he's convinced he's going to die. And the fact that he has happened to sit next to Americans eating dinner might be the most fortuitous thing that has happened to him in the last decade. And he is convinced, if he can just convince me that this is real, that this matters, that I can put in a call to President Biden himself. And I don't, there's no good ending to this story, right? We had to get away from, it. It was dark and uncomfortable. I think our interpreter gave him a fake number. But you know, the these are rough men willing to do violence in defense of their nation. And I don't know. It's lingered with me, obviously. I wished I had some kind of closure or ending to that story, but it stuck with me for a reason, because I think it's relevant to your question.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back. It's interesting to me that you say, the way you're framing this, because it is... the Ukrainian perspective is that the Biden administration has not done as much as they would like for them to do. But looking from this perspective, the Biden administration seems the only people who are in America who are actually interested. I mean, at least the Democrats seem supportive of supplying Ukraine, whereas there is a faction of the country in the Republican Party that wants to stop this entirely. I guess Ukrainians don't understand that difference or care, maybe.
It's what they know, I think, right? Like, they've lived the past few years with the Biden administration from their perspective, and it's one I personally agree with, kind of supplying half measures, trying to kind of overmanage the war. I mean, there was a real window in the autumn of 2022 when they were making incredible advances before the Russian defenses had set in, with the minefields in particular, where had we given them the kind of long-range missiles and artillery that they'd been requesting, more gains could have been made, right? So that's what they point to. It is hard to convey the unknown. I haven't talked to them since Tucker Carlson's interview with Putin, or former President Trump's insane rambling today about how he would let Russia invade even NATO countries. So, you know, there is kind of like a superficial awareness that this is better than the alternative, but it's hard to dismiss the lived experience of these last 2 years.
If you're turning into YouTube, you can see my face upon learning that Trump said that today, because I was asleep during the American daytime, and I'm like, what? Can't even fucking sleep in that guy.
Welcome back to the Trump is politician news cycle, which is you miss 1 hour and something insane again.
You just published an op-ed in the Boston Globe arguing that the U.S. should continue to fund Ukraine's self-defense, stating that this isn't a forever war. In that piece, you note that the term forever war is, quote, lifted from a 1974 science fiction novel and became a type of catch-all during the latter half of the War on Terror, a way to neatly refer to Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and beyond without getting bogged down in the particulars. So why does that term important to understand, and why does it not apply to what's happening in Ukraine?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, Whit. So it comes from a 1974 science fiction novel written by Joel Haldeman, who himself was a Vietnam veteran. And then it was kind of recycled in a really great book in, I think, 2006, 2007, a nonfiction book about Iraq written by the New Yorker writer Dexter Filkins. And it makes sense from kind of an American perspective, right? Like, war is someplace we go elsewhere. By and large, in the last 50, 60 years, these have been wars of choice. These have been kind of futile imperial adventures where we have been humbled, but nobody has suffered other than American taxpayers, American soldiers, and certainly the local populations tremendously, right? And these experiences have and should influence the way we as citizens think about foreign war. I get it. I'm not a hawk. I hope anybody familiar with my work knows that. I've written some terrible things that I stand by about the military industrial complex. All that said, sometimes in the world, necessary wars occur, right? Not good wars, but necessary wars. And I think anybody who's had a 5-minute, 10-minute conversation with a Ukrainian or Ukrainian-American understands that this is one of those, right? All you have to do is watch a little bit of the Tucker Carlson interview with Vladimir Putin the other day, or just listen to things that Putin has said or read before. He does not believe Ukraine should exist. He believes it's a fake country. He wants to smash out the language. He wants to smash out the culture. And this didn't arise from him. This is an old, Soviet Stalin did the same thing. You know, it goes way, way back. There's a culture and a history here that is very real. And I worry tremendously that as Americans, we're so used to kind of viewing war through this kind of forever war prism, right? Where war is a choice, where in the modern era, volunteer soldiers can choose to go and fight and kill and die. That we're forgetting things like Ukrainian agency, that we're forgetting that peace does not mean an end of armed conflict, right? Like let's say America and the EU stop supporting Ukraine tomorrow, right? The Ukrainian military gets overwhelmed. That's not the beginning of peace. If anything, that's the start of even more horror, right? Cities will be completely razed. Genocide will occur in the actual definition of the term. So if you believe in peace, if you seek peace, you have to don't listen to me. I'm an American writer, and you can think whatever you want about me, but actually listen to what Ukrainians are saying. And not just, mouthpieces, right? Like not politicians, not Zelensky, not his PR team. Talk to some of the people I've met, any kind of journalists, people in Eastern Ukraine, the kind of people that Putin says he's saving, he's rescuing, who want to be part of Russian society, who are who have lost grandsons, who have lost neighbors in this war, and are now full-throated Ukrainian in a way they weren't 3 years ago. Just have a little intellectual humility and stop viewing everything through our American prism. And maybe you'll reconsider why this war is happening and why it needs to be supported.
So, so much of what you're saying is fascinating because it's translated in a really interesting way to your novel, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But there is a character who gives a speech that's sort of along the lines of what you were just saying. So we were talking about, kind of like equipment shortages and things. And one of the things I was reading about was that Ukraine is specifically facing an ammunition shortage. And last year, last year, 2023, Russia was facing an equipment shortage. So it was like interesting that both sides are having this at like different moments. At the top of the show, we were talking about the emergency aid bills being discussed in the Senate. Presumably the Senate is working on this weekend. I don't know that I have much faith that politicians are working in any real way, but they're talking about sending $60 billion to Ukraine. This is like tagged to a bill that also has emergency aid for Israel in it. Can you talk about how this money would change things for Ukraine and the conversation in Ukraine around the equipment shortages and U.S. aid?
Sure. Yeah, I sometimes worry that because it makes total sense that these aid packages get tagged with kind of specific numbers. But, you know, if you delve into what it means, it's not just money, right? We're not sending Zelensky a $61 billion check. With this particular package, if it gets through, you know, about one third of that actually is to restock American defense contractors that have already sold weapons and artillery and air defense equipment to Ukraine. So when I see Republicans in particular pushing back on this, suddenly being against American defense contracting, I'm just baffled. I'm baffled by the domestic politics of this. I think 15 to 20 million will go, is money going to Ukraine to be able to purchase defense equipment from your other European allies, right? So it's almost kind of a bonus to the EU package that was passed last week that is going towards Ukraine. Some of it has nothing to do with war or weapons. I believe about half a billion of this package goes directly to internally displaced Ukrainians, right? Is earmarked specifically to help Eastern Ukrainians who've had to flee to Kyiv in the center or the western regions of the country to escape all this, right? So even the most humanitarian anti-war person on the planet, whether on the hard left or the hard right, would believe, hey, that's taxpayer money that's going someplace real and meaningful. So it's frustrating sometimes that this can be framed simply as a money thing. But you know, the money that goes to the weapons is very real. In the op-ed that Whit mentioned, I make note of the fact that, you know, Russians are firing about 10 artillery shells for every one the Ukrainians now manage. It's a huge part of the war. Every Western vet that I've interviewed over there that served in Iraq or Afghanistan cannot stop talking about the difference of what weapons from the sky mean, particularly heavy artillery, but also drone bombs, and how different that is than what my generation of American soldiers experienced. Air defense weapons is another aspect of this. The interceptors in particular have been very successful protecting the big cities in Ukraine, Kyiv and Odessa, Lviv out west. These are protecting innocent civilians from random Russian missiles. Unless you're living under a rock, you have to realize that the Russians have zero interest in targeting only military targets. I've walked through the wreckage myself. A great Ukrainian young woman named Victoria Amelina, who's a Ukrainian writer, happened to be eating in the wrong pizzeria at the wrong time last summer and was killed. A complete war crime. Innocent families going out to dinner, nowhere near a barracks, nowhere near a base, nowhere near an artillery position, a Ukrainian artillery position. This is what this money is going to. It is not helping Ukrainian military advance so much as it is helping Ukrainian society survive and endure. These are real people's lives. This is a real culture. This is a real society. And I don't know. I wish more of that was kind of being injected in this conversation. And if nothing else, it would force some of the detractors and skeptics of our support to confront the reality of what they're naysaying.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back. It's interesting to me because I think a lot about like how the myth of war or what war means to Americans like changes over time, right? And so I, you know, once wrote an essay for the New Republic about war movies, and I was pointing, one of my arguments was that the rise of like pro World War II movies, like that glorified the Greatest Generation, movies like Saving Private Ryan, but also The Greatest Generation. Wasn't that a movie? Or at least it was Brokaw's book. Wasn't that made into a movie? Right.
TV show, I think.
Those types of movies and films in the 90s made it much easier for George Bush to go to war in Iraq because people thought that it was this glorious thing with great purpose. And unfortunately, that did not turn out to be true in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, and yet this is the war, right, that most resembles World War II, where you have a clearly fascist, totalitarian dictator on the other side, and you have a democratic society that's resisting him. And, you know, he's murdering civilians and torturing people and doing terrible things that we know are happening. And it seems like that is, if there's anything at all that, you know, America is just, maybe we just got worn out by being in so many stupid wars since World War II that we can't actually recognize that this is something resembling that.
Yes. First of all, that essay that you wrote from the New Republic was excellent. I remember it. And I think you're on to something. Like, what's the one thing that unites all of this is kind of American hubris. Right, that the idea that, gosh, it's been over 20 years now, but that we would go to these countries, take out a dictator, and establish democracy from the top down in the name of freedom, insane, genuinely insane. Looking back on it, and then 20 years later, you know, for very good reasons, American people are skeptical. The American people are, some of whom had direct connections to those wars and feel betrayed by our government and by the defense complex, are wondering why this is any different. And it takes intellectual humility to just take a step back and consider how and why it is. Because otherwise, you're falling under the same kind of hubristic tendency that you condemned George Bush for, right? Like believing that Ukraine is that the Maidan social uprising in 2013 was a CIA plot is just as full of American hubris as George Bush was back in 03, thinking that, or Donald Rumsfeld was thinking that it would be a short war in Iraq and that we wouldn't, there wouldn't be any kind of insurgency. Right. Don't get me wrong. Ukraine is a flawed country. Right. It's been trying through fits and starts since it gained independence in 1991 to kind of purge itself of its demons. The corruption issues that have made international news are real, but it's been making incremental progress. You know, every 5 to 10 years, the country has had an internal social protest movement, trying to become more democratic, trying to become more part of Europe. This is not the propping up of a democracy from the top down. This is the defensive one, and it's flawed. But guess what? So is ours. All you have to do is pick up a newspaper and realize we should not be proclaiming down at anybody about a complicated population trying to figure it out. I don't know. It's frustrating to me because I have friends across the political spectrum that I ask consistently, sometimes more politely than others, more politely than other times, just take a step back and consider this from a Ukrainian perspective, and consider, like, just take a look at their history and realize that, like, they want what we have, or they want what they think we have. And, like, here's an actual opportunity for America to be what we always proclaim to be, what we always aspire to be. And we're going to drop the ball? I've never been more patriotic than when I was over there talking to everyday Ukrainians about what they think America is. And I've been, I don't know if I, even after my experience in Iraq, man, I don't think I've ever been more dispirited about what my country actually is than watching what we're doing to Ukraine right now.
So, Matt, we've been alluding to your new novel, Daybreak, which really reflects some of these experiences and ideas and arguments that you're talking about in the form, of course, of characters, including the 33-year-old Army veteran Luke Paxton, aka Pax, who goes to Ukraine, not exactly to fight, but kind of like to help, as he says. He's kind of struggling to articulate why he's there. You went to Ukraine yourself and trained civilians in combat and survival skills. And in an op-ed for the New York Times that you wrote like maybe a little bit after, you kind of cautioned veterans and others interested in going to have a clear sense of how they plan to help. Now, how did you find your way from your own experience and kind of that argument to the character of Pax and his motivations?
Sure. So, you know, Luke Paxton and his colleague, Han Lee, who he goes over with, are very much informed by the type of veteran I met over there who did not heed my op-ed's call. And we're going to help. And, you know, there's something tremendously brave about that. But there's also something deeply flawed about that, right? These are complicated, messed up, flawed people in many ways. It is not a normal thing to be able to take off from your regular life and go to a war zone on a whim. I say that with some hypocrisy, perhaps. But I was just kind of fascinated by the dichotomy of the physical and moral courage of what they were doing in pursuing the defense of an ideal and an idea, but also the kind of the hard reality that these are messed up people in some cases with real dark, murky pasts who maybe haven't thought through the potential ramifications of what they're doing and the long-term consequences of that, not just on themselves, but on Ukraine, on their families back home, et cetera. And, you know, fiction, nothing's better than kind of exploring the murky grays of existence than fiction. So putting some of these men and women that I'd met over there into characters for this book, I don't know, just made all the sense in the world.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
Would you read a little bit from the novel for us?
Oh, I'd be glad to, sure. I'm going to read from a couple pages. It's early in the book in chapter 2. And what has happened is Han Lee has been accepted into the International Legion by a Ukrainian military recruiter. But because of his murky past and his kind of very visible post-traumatic stress, Pax has been rejected. So he is kind of simultaneously coming to terms with his failures as a soldier in the past, and also kind of what he perceives to be his failures as a man in the present. And he's quite literally stumbling around a city and country that he doesn't know, he doesn't understand. He's about as lost of a soul as you can get. And then the air raid siren goes off, because Russian bombers are en route. The witch wail of a siren cut through the city, strident, demanding. Pax hesitated under a naked chestnut tree along the wide pathway while people separated from the crowd piecemeal, some running, others trotting out, all moving with intent. Air raid, a passing voice said to him, and he thought, oh wow, but also, am I that obvious? Most bodies were streaming for a block of stairs that led down to something like an underpass. Pax began hurrying that way, his hands trembling and his skin rising with goosebumps. In Afghanistan, they'd controlled the skies, always. This was totally different. What, he thought, could be up there? He looked and tried to see, but there was only more gray. Nearing the Virgin Mary statue, Pax saw that not everyone had sought cover. Some Ukrainians had made the choice of nothing. A babushka shuffled along the pathway with an unbothered grimness. A group of teens in emo makeup lingered around the monument of black slab, performatively sharing a blunt. And a street artist, the same one he'd seen earlier, sat on a bench, legs crossed, blinking away at the day. She noticed Pax and lifted her sketchpad at him. Despite himself, despite everything, he took a seat on the adjacent bench. The artist was sallow and gray, 60 or so, wearing a waxed jacket and a black knit cap on her head, half cocked. Her fingers were covered in tattoos, and she said something to Pax he didn't understand. He said no, then asked, English? The woman rolled her eyes and said something else he didn't understand. Then she began sketching. Pax focused as much as he could on being normal. He took long breaths to steady himself and adjusted his headband for the drawing. He listened to the thump of his heart and the insistence of the siren. Fuck, he thought, looking up at the opaque sky again. What's fucking up there? The artist barked at him, probably with a curse, he thought, and he returned his attention to ground level. What had Lee said about profanity? Sometimes it's the only expression of human decency left to us. But fuck, Pax thought again. Nothing about this feels decent. What is up there? He slid his prayer beads from his wrist and clasped them between his hands like jewels. The siren kept wailing, and he kept rubbing one bead over and over, feeling its chipped turquoise paint with a fingertip. It calmed him, as he knew it would. Sometimes, always when he'd been drinking, usually when trying to impress a woman, Pax would say the beads had been a gift from an Afghan child. A boy he'd become friends with, the son of a respected elder and ally, a man just like him who wanted dignity and purpose, and to leave the earth a little bit better than he'd found it. He'd even given the boy a name, Ali, and Ali was a mischievous sort, peddling the Americans' DVDs and cigarettes in markup. He was a good kid, though, a good kid, part of a new generation of Afghans who grew up knowing freedom and democracy and all those other fancy words that sound hollow to people who already have them, but mean so much to those who don't. It was a lie, though, all of it, a figment twisted up by some demented corner of his brain. A harmless one, Pax thought most mornings after, but stupid, something I shouldn't do anymore. Most of the Afghan children his platoon encountered either screamed for chocolate or fled. In the valley over from them, Navy SEALs had wasted some civilians, and word had got around. He'd found the beads in the dirt during a patrol through some know-nothing mountain village. Then he'd stuck them in his pocket without bothering to look and see if they might belong to one of the locals watching them from the windows of their mud huts. He'd brought the beads back to the American outpost and cleaned them under canteen water. To have a war trophy, to have something that proved he'd gone and done something exceptional. It was only years later, driving home from a bar through empty dark, that he considered the possibility that someone else, far across the globe, someone who'd watched the act through a window, maybe believed he'd stolen the beads. And then he maybe believed he had. The air raid siren strangled out halfway through its pitch, replaced by the stun of its absence. Pax held his pose for the artist, realizing his internal dread from earlier had been overtaken by a more corporal, dull ache. Which is good, he thought. I can deal with this. People were trickling back to the pathway. As the artist clucked to herself and began erasing something hard, a shape appeared to his side. It was a girl, brown hair, flat brow, wearing a large man's coat down to her knees, her fingers poking out of a rolled back cuffs like little sausages. Her hair was greasy and matted, and she smelled of stale urine. Hello, Pax said. She replied in Ukrainian and put out her arms like a plane, lips rumbling to make an engine noise. Only then did he recognize her. She'd bumped into him earlier on the pathway. Ooga booga, he tried again, and this time she grinned wide. A set of crooked teeth splayed out, a not insignificant gap along the top row. Despite her appearance, she carried herself with an air of pomposity. Pax guessed her to be about 11. With her head, she gestured towards his clasped hands. Wanna see? He opened his palms so she could view the prayer beads. The girl stepped forward, her tiny eyes not on the beads at all, but pressing on him, looking at Pax in such a way that made him feel like she was staring through him into all the moral insecurity that growing up in a free country can instill. Then came the sting of a slap across his face. As he winced, he felt his hands empty. Holding his jaw, Pax looked up. The child was running away from the bench with a second girl, older, bow-legged, their prayer beads in her grip.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
Pax and his friend Han Lee were in the 173rd Airborne together in Afghanistan, you know, and now they go together to do this trip and end up, you know, they're separated. And as you pointed out, as you mentioned earlier, Lee in particular, he's there because he wants to kill without feeling guilt. I don't know, is that a fair gloss on what his motivations are? But what about Pax? I mean, it's interesting to me, you know, like, I'm very curious. And I said on this podcast that I was nervous when I heard that you were going over there. Like, you know, I feel like it's I intuitively understand why American soldiers would go there, sometimes for the reasons that I was talking about in the prior statement. Like, this is the kind of war that I think a lot of soldiers would have preferred to be in than the one that they ended up getting to fight in. Is that what Pax is motivating Pax, or is it something else? I mean, how do you conceive of his inner want here?
It's part of it. You know, one of the recurring questions in the novel posed to them by many various Ukrainians is, why are you here? And that was a question we faced, particularly when we went over as volunteers. We had a kind of a clean, direct answer, which is to help train civilians, and that you know, we're here for 3 to 4 weeks, and then we're going home. And that seemed to satisfy most people. Han Lee has a very clear, direct answer that seems to satisfy most people, which is, I'm here to kill Russians. It's kind of messed up in some ways, but when your country's under threat, and particularly when you're a Ukrainian military recruiter, that is what you want to hear. Pax, almost to his detriment, is honest. He's not quite sure. He's figuring that out, I think, on most pages of this book. Maybe until really kind of the last chapter. He wants to help, but he doesn't know how. And I think what you just said, Whit, is exactly why he's there, is that I think Pax is a decent human being that maybe doesn't have, hasn't figured it all out. That, you know, a messed up, unnecessary, flawed war turned him into a messed up, flawed human being. And he's still sorting through that.
I mean, he's been damaged, you know. Those prayer beads that are in that passage that you read, you know, those are his war memento, but that actually are an expression of his war trauma, you know. I mean, the way that, you know, that he is shell-shocked, to use an older term.
He's stuck there. Unlike one of the key things that I wanted to show with the difference between him and Svetlana, they'd been lovers 10 years before, is she's moved on. This current war.
Svetlana is, we haven't talked about her yet. So this
sure.
is a woman that he
this
has
is a Ukrainian.
Prior.
Yes, a Ukrainian
he's
woman.
He's hoping to see.
Correct. Yeah, she has moved on. She's a mother now. She's lived a life. The current war is threatening to trap her in the same way that the Afghanistan war trapped Paxton, right? I'll be blunt. He has severe post-traumatic stress in a way that...
That was the term I was looking for.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, he would fight, like, he might fight that. It's a complicated thing.
Anyone reading the character
for
can
sure.
see that.
So he is deeply unsatisfied with life in America. And he's hoping that Ukraine and maybe also Svetlana can give him some kind of renewed sense of purpose. And in some ways that's kind of pathetic. In some ways I find it very inspiring that because for him, the last time he remembers being happy, the last time he remembers having direction was with her right before he deployed to Afghanistan. And the world has moved on, even if his mind hasn't. And that is the entry point I think readers find him at as they're riding the bus into Ukraine on page one.
So one of the things I appreciate is, I mean, we're with him, but also, right, the book takes detours into other points of view, and you have gone to some, like, so, right, like this moment, there's this, I mean, the beads, we asked you to read this passage because it's like, there's this, right, the beads being snatched from him by this child have this, like, this great symbolic weight. And, by a child who's trapped in a war that's very different than the one that he came from, kind of as you were speaking about earlier. And so that's a moment of agency that you see kind of like civilian life in all like these multiple forms during an air raid. And then, of course, also Svetlana and other kind of like activists with whom she works. So you kind of work to, despite, you know, we see things through PAX, but we also see the ways in which he's like sometimes unable, he's unable to sometimes reconcile things in his head, but we have the information actually to kind of like get the portrayal, which is really great. Can you talk a little bit about like kind of portraying civilians and how you thought about doing that?
Sure. No, I'm thrilled to hear that came through, because that was, even on draft one, page one, that was a huge intent of mine. I was keenly aware that I'm working in kind of a specific tradition, Hemingway, Conrad, Graham Greene, or, you know, Orwell, like white man from the West goes to a foreign country in the midst of conflict, hoping to help, I don't want to dismiss those authors. Their books have meant a great deal to me as a person, and in some ways have helped shape them. But, you know, the world in the 21st century is very different. America's relationship to the world is very different. And capturing, formative experience in my life, frankly, in Iraq was understanding that my scout platoon was only there for 15 months, which is a not short time, but that for the Iraqis that we were living amongst, that we were working with, that we were fighting, this was everything. You know, this had been a decade of their life, and it would endure after we left. And that has shaped every sentence I've ever written. So tapping into the Ukrainian perspective, tapping into the civilian perspective was vital. I would not have sat down and tried to write this novel without pursuing those things. It was very important to me. To end on a Ukrainian note, for example, I didn't, when I first sat down to write this book, I wasn't quite sure, even though I knew it was would be largely told from Pax's perspective, I knew I would end from a Ukrainian character. I just didn't quite know yet, quite know which one yet. So kind of providing these kind of short but powerful glimpses into other characters' perspectives, not just about PAX, but about these internationals showing up and quote unquote helping. I don't know. I think it just allowed me to layer this book and populate it with some complexity and nuance that just, I don't know if it would have been possible if I'd always stayed from PAX's perspective or always an American perspective.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us. And listeners, don't miss Daybreak, which will be available in your local independent bookstore on Tuesday. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and always a pleasure to talk with you all. Thank you.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!